I've got three subjects today. One is around the FASB accounting changes and how that affects the pricing of public companies like MicroStrategy. The second topic is around the virality of Bitcoin and the nature of a bottom-up grassroots system and network. And then finally, the process of setting a vision and having a self-image and how important that is to your direction and what you actually manage to progress towards and achieve. So first of all, the FASB accounting change. So this is bloody niche, right? Like most people have no idea what even this thing is. I, as a experienced investor, don't even really know what it is. But in the United States, publicly traded equities are accountable to this accounting board. And in particular, it's interesting because they changed the rules. And there was the pre-2024 rules and the post-2024 rules, specifically in relation to Bitcoin and how Bitcoin is accounted for. And what it means is that the shift in how you account for Bitcoin on the balance sheet of your company, let's say your MicroStrategy or Block or Tesla that own Bitcoin on the balance sheet, every quarter, the price gain or loss of Bitcoin gets marked to market and it counts as earnings. So in a sense, the balance sheet is actually now able to create revenue. So even though you just sat and owned Bitcoin for 3 months, quarter to quarter, and you haven't sold it, you haven't lent it to anyone, you've done literally nothing but just sit on it, if it does a 10% shift to the upside, then if you're holding 100 grand's worth of Bitcoin, it looks like from an accounting perspective, you just made $10,000. And so this is a massive deal. And shout out to a new friend of mine on Nostr called Jason the Original that I only came across due to his post yesterday. Basically, everyone needs to pay attention. This is a big shift. And it highlights a number of things. So for me, first of all, what I'll talk through is the idea of being ruled by rules and not by rulers. And so one of the reasons that I have come to love Bitcoin is because it doesn't change. That's why it gets called things like a pet rock. But since 2009, when it launched, the rules that govern the system have remained almost identical to when they started. The network has grown over time in terms of strength due to the improvements that have been made to it by Bitcoin core developers and anyone else that's combed through the open source software and gone, this doesn't quite make sense, or maybe we can make the UX better by making this change. And those updates are called BIPs. And the underlying rules of the system, they haven't changed. Fixed supply of 21 million, issuance schedule over 100 so years. Now, what FASB have done is they've basically changed the rules. So the way that you value a company is now different because of a sleight of hand by some, I don't even know who they are, right? And it's interesting because it highlights very, very well how excellent Bitcoin is at what it says it is, which is a monetary network. And it's very, very useful for measuring value. Really what this highlights is like, okay, how far is it from here to my next door neighbor? Well, it's a number of meters. Does a meter change over time? No, this is a commonly agreed distance that we measure things with. Now, measuring value using dollars, well, hang on, what if the value of the dollar itself is changing? Well, you're suddenly using a measuring stick that is like, is it a meter and 10% this year? Or is it a meter and 6% this year? Or maybe you're somewhere that's hyperinflating and it's actually 2 meters is now the equivalent to a year ago. And this is very confusing, right? It really screws with the head because what it ultimately means is that we are measuring economics with a stick that is constantly changing. And how can you make efficient economic decisions if the measuring stick is all over the chip shop? Like, you can't. And that's why you see like gross misallocation of capital all over the place, in particular when interest rates are close to zero for a handful of people that can get hold of them that cheap and then deploy capital elsewhere. And if it goes wrong, it's like, oh, well, look, the debt didn't cost us anything anyway. So, oh, well, we're bankrupt. And you just write the entity off. And it's just mad what you see happening. Like grotesque misallocations of capital, often with you know, modern government heavily involved with no accountability, etc. But it's like, okay, so if Bitcoin is a system where the rules don't change, yes, people say, oh my God, it's so volatile. But like, hello, people are volatile. Like the Jake that woke up this morning is different to the Jake that went to bed last night. Or equally now, this wonderful example I like talking, it's so simple. And this is where the Austrian School of Economics is so fascinating, is that value is subjective. So each person has a different value for the same thing. And so let's say this water bottle, right now to me, oh, it's cost me however much it cost me to buy. I filled it up with my water machine downstairs. Cool. Pretty simple process. I'm in the Sahara Desert. I'm thirsty as fuck. That is worth hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. But it's the same thing. And so the self-interest of the individual economic actor is critical to the value they place on things around them. And this is why human action, as it's so called, is such an interesting thing to study. Because it starts to shine a light on like why things actually happen. And it's not about some niche algebraic concept with a microeconomist from the Keynesian school that's trying to explain how, you know, having an employment cap actually improves people's lives. It's the complete opposite of that. It's like you go to someone and you say, what's going to help you? And they'll then make their own decision and say, well, that would. And it's just very different. So where's this going? So Bitcoin is this thing that it doesn't change over time because the rules are fixed. And there's then a set of nodes that keep all of the Bitcoin transactions. And they're kind of like an accountant in a way, but the accountant that can't change, right? Unlike the FASB. And so that's one of the reasons why I think Bitcoin is so compelling as a monetary network, is because you can't shift it. And that makes a big difference when we're looking to value things over time, because, oh, hang on, I can use the same measuring stick. Now, people will bang on about, you know, unit of account. And like when something's so short-term volatile, how do you have a consistent unit of account to measure value? Fair enough. Well, that's why I think the stablecoin market has proved to be so successful, is because people still really want that, right? They don't want their money to potentially chop in half in 6 months' time. Fair enough. But what if the volatility of Bitcoin is actually a fairer reflection of human behavior? And the cost of capital and the cost of money fluctuates radically from day to day. One day, everyone's super excited, the world's rosy, everything's great, and the greed index is going crazy. And then the next day, it's like, oh my God, there's going to be a world war and we're all going to be nuked to death. They're super scared. Of course, the cost of capital changes depending on the common behavioral mindset of the participants in an economy, which even more shines a light then on how ridiculous it is that there's a bunch of central bankers that think they can get together every 6 weeks and decide between 12 of them, all 70 to 80 years old, that actually, yeah, the interest rate should be 4% right now. Yeah, that's definitely correct. And it's this idea of a centralized economy versus a decentralized economy. And who's going to be more efficient as a capital allocator? The individual with a specific set of self-interests that can make decisions very, very quickly based on what's happening around them, or the group of individuals that are making guesses based on what they think other people want. To me, it's very, very clear. Anyway, to get back to FASB, what's actually happening here? Well, basically, the way that public companies, so this is stock traded, this is equities traded on public markets in the US. Let's take MicroStrategy as an example. The Bitcoin MicroStrategy now owns on its balance sheet can effectively be used to represent revenue. So they're not selling the Bitcoin. They're not loaning it to anyone. It's literally just holding it on the balance sheet. And if Bitcoin goes up in price over a quarter, then that increase in the value of the Bitcoin counts as revenue for that business. Now, this is a radical change, right? Since when does the balance sheet of a business represent revenue? So you're not selling anything. You have a product. You're literally just a Bitcoin balance sheet play that people are then buying equity in. Now, either they're raising debt, so they're selling bonds, or they're selling different types of equity shares, so preference shares or at-the-market shares, different ways of kind of getting access and exposure to MicroStrategy. And again, this gets pretty niche, right? Like how many investors are looking at this stuff? How many investors understand the difference between convertible notes, i.e. the bond investors, or people who are buying equity straight from the market? I don't think it's many people. And admittedly, even myself, that's why, you know, shout out to Jason. This has hit me so hard in the last 24 hours. It's like, hang on a second. So the accounting rules are changing. Now, I knew this was happening, but forgive me, I wasn't looking closely enough. And one of those reasons is because I'm just long Bitcoin in self-custody. I'm not actually looking to reallocate into anything else. And lots of other people spend plenty of time doing that. Like, how can I outpace Bitcoin? Well, one way of doing that is potentially buying leveraged equities in the public markets that have taken on Bitcoin in their treasury. And it's working very well for some people. That's something I might look at in maybe 6 to 10 months once I see a liquidity opportunity for a market top with Bitcoin itself. It's like, okay, maybe it makes sense to take some profits off the table, sit on that for maybe another 6 to 12 months, and then reinvest at the bottom of the next cycle, if I believe that's actually going to happen at the time. I do think it will. I don't think cycles are disappearing by any means. But since when can balance sheet growth, so net asset value change, count as revenue? Whoa. Now, to peel back the layer in terms of like how do you value things? Well, obviously, value is subjective, as we've discussed. And so an individual investor will have a different opinion of different things at different times. And I love that, right? If you're wrong, your money's gone, or it's not as much as it was before, i.e. you buy something right now and the market actually sells off and you were wrong. Or you got the timing wrong, which is like actually you should have held it for longer than you did, or whatever the case might be. So you need to have strategies around entry points, like when are you going to buy it? Not only what are you going to buy, but when, and then also when you might sell. And so I'm like, holy shit, this actually isn't what I thought, where it's like, okay, if it's common knowledge that you can take Bitcoin onto the balance sheet, like why won't lots of other entities start doing that? And they might well do that, right? So instead of buying MicroStrategy, you can go and buy lots of other different things that are essentially a quasi-Bitcoin play. But none of them will have as many Bitcoins as MicroStrategy, which means the value of MicroStrategy is going to increase faster. Now, of course, things might be proportional, so that the, let's say a smaller company takes on a significant amount of Bitcoin that's percentage-wise similar to a MicroStrategy, then maybe you can ride the same speed of growth if other investors are looking at the same thing. I don't know. And this is what I'm keen to learn more about and find out. But it's just one of those crazy things. Oh, so hang on. They're changing the accounting rules. And if they change the accounting rules, then basically it's that, like, the map is not the territory. And so you might be using a certain map, but that map's now old and it's shifted. And this is where it's basically information arbitrage. Like, people are using information to their benefit before other people get hold of it. Incidentally, that's what I argue Bitcoin is, full stop, right? I'm just extraordinarily lucky to have drawn the dots together in a way that was like, oh, wow. Not only do I think this has a huge chance of success, the market's massively undervaluing it currently. And actually, it represents something I think can bring a far, far brighter future than what the status quo financial system represents. Okay, I'm in. Let's do this. And, you know, number of years into the journey now, here we are. And it's like, oh, look, oh, they've just changed the accounting rules. What's going to happen next? And so where does this take me to? It's like, okay, we're talking about fundamentally different systems. Like, Bitcoin represents an entirely different system. Peer-to-peer electronic cash. Wow. So when you're buying into it and you're holding self-custody, it's just a completely different world to the stock market, to the bond market, to regulated equities. And that's okay. And you can embrace that and you can use that to your own benefits. So where will the public markets shift? Well, obviously, if you can get paid in terms of equity return for having Bitcoin on your balance sheet, well, people are going to get into it. So what does this mean? Perhaps huge demand for Bitcoin coming in. Now, obviously, like, will they buy Bitcoin specifically onto their balance sheet, or will they buy an ETF? Who knows? I'm very dubious around the ability to kind of make a derivative of Bitcoin. So the good example that should be easier to kind of get your head around is the gold market, right? There's a certain amount of gold that we believe exists above ground. Of course, like, the recent chatter around actually auditing Fort Knox is fascinating. And, you know, do central banks actually have as much gold as they claim? I don't know. And let's try and find out over the next kind of, you know, 6 to 12 months. But the point being is that when you look at the amount of derivatives of gold, there is a lot more paper claims for the physical amount of gold that exists. And I can't remember what the leverage is, which is annoying, but I feel like it's massive, right? There's like 10 or 12 times the amount of paper claims for physical gold. And the physical gold market's valued at like roughly $18 trillion US globally today. So like total above ground gold that is claimed to be there is a circa $20 trillion market. And for the Bitcoin bulls, it's like, okay, well, Bitcoin's digital gold. I actually think it's a 10x on gold in a number of different ways. It's the ability to transfer value over space and time that shits all over gold. Like gold is good at holding value over time, but it's not very good at sending it across space. You know, how do you chop up a gold bar? It's really difficult. And it was that failure of gold in some senses to actually facilitate trade that silver, you know, was very useful, right? Even bronze coins. But as soon as that happened, you had to trust someone to send the gold across space. And like Lynn Alden's book, Broken Money, is fascinating for this and basically points out very nicely that the development of telecommunications technology was the day that gold failed, in a sense, because you cannot wire gold from Australia to New York on a phone call, you know, or on a telegraph even. You know, this has been happening for 100 years, roughly. And that's fascinating, right? So it's like, okay, well, what's going to actually happen? Okay, Bitcoin's better than gold. Gold's worth $20 trillion. Well, let's imagine like a total addressable market calculation. Like, well, Bitcoin could just eat the whole of gold. Why not? And I don't necessarily calculate that as my bullish price for Bitcoin, but like, let's ask that question. Could Bitcoin completely replace gold as a monetary item? Well, why not? If it's better at sending money over time and sending money over space, what's the point of gold? I would argue in many ways, like we're just still so early on Bitcoin that the average person still associates gold as being valuable money. But the day that they go, actually, hang on, the fact that I can walk around with my money in a seed phrase in my head rather than this big gold coin in my pocket, well, that's way better because it can't be stolen from you and you can send it anywhere at any time for a fraction of the cost. It's like, whoa, this is super powerful. But we're not there yet, right? The fact there's still a $20 trillion market cap on gold tells you that. It also, of course, has a capacity to be used in jewelry and in electronics, etc. So it has a more of a utility value too, which would mean that it doesn't completely disintegrate in market cap. This brings me nicely to then really think through like, well, how do you value, like I touched on before, how do you value a company? Well, there's lots of different ways. So net asset value is one thing to look at. Like what does the company actually own? But then you can look at revenues. It's like, okay, how profitable is this business? Are they keeping their costs down? How much debt have they taken on? If you're doing early stage investments, you're not really looking at data per se. You're actually thinking, okay, does this person have a big potential to create a world-changing business? And what kind of market size are they getting into? And okay, I'm gonna put some money into this early stage, highly risky, very illiquid bet, but I think the outcome chances are higher than the potential downside. Okay. Point is, there's lots of different ways to value businesses, whether it be the balance sheet, whether it be the operational side of the company. And what FASB is doing is basically changing the landscape. And so for people that are actually watching, they're able to make decisions based on that. And it's cool in that it's probably a fairer... Actually, is it fairer to say that Bitcoin gains equals revenue? I don't agree with that, thinking about it, which is interesting, right? So it's an accounting wizardry. So this massive bull market that we might see in MicroStrategy stock, is it just vaporware? And the thing that then brings me to nice is like, depending on how you look at valuing the company, that's up to you. Your value of something is subjective. So you're going to make a decision based on what you see. Maybe it's just a traditional value investor that comes along and says, look, I think the price to earnings is actually, this is a good buy. Let's do it. The capital growth potential is absolutely fantastic. And it's worth doing for that reason alone. But there's the upside and also the downside. And so how MicroStrategy specifically is able to navigate that process of a Bitcoin bull market and then the inevitable sell-off, right? It's not going to happen. I think anyone out there that tells you that Bitcoin's going up forever doesn't actually know what they're talking about. And that's very simple, because it's like pushing something underwater. You can push it under a little bit and it pops back up. You can push it back under more and it pops back up. You push it back even further and it pops back even further. That, I think, is going to be the route to market for Bitcoin in terms of price action. It's constantly going to be volatile. And that's because humans are volatile. And also the idea that it's a completely inelastic good, right? If the gold price goes up, we mine more gold. If the silver price goes up, we get more silver. If the grain price goes up, you know, we create more grain, like the classic kind of commodity picture. It's like, well, if the Bitcoin price goes up, you can't make more of this stuff. And that's where there's something called a Veblen good. It's particularly prominent in luxury market. So, you know, there'll be basically two or three, let's think about it like this. Or I heard recently, actually, so Rolex produced 1.2 million watches a year. Does that sound a lot, or does that not sound very much? Other competitors of theirs in that ultra luxury watch space produce half that or a quarter of that. But the demand for Rolex is so high that actually there's a certain subset of those Rolexes produced each year where they're done in such a small number that people buying them buy the most expensive one. They specifically are trying to buy the most expensive one. So, and that's what a Veblen good is. Basically, as the price goes up, the demand goes up. And that's what Bitcoin is. So I'm chilled. I'm sitting in Bitcoin self-custody. I'm looking at all these different reasons why I think that's a good bet. And I don't really need to care about what's going on in the public markets. And neither should you. And I think that's the base case. Like, get to that point. But then the next part is like, well, how do you outpace the hurdle rate that's Bitcoin? And that's where things like this information about FASB coming in are really interesting. Like, will the behavior of these publicly listed companies shift because of the fact they can access Bitcoin more easily with an ETF, and equally the fact they can look at Bitcoin gains as a form of revenue, which has an impact on their equities, which undoubtedly, you know, shareholder value is what these CEOs are trying to drive. Like, that's very enticing. So, like, we could be in for one hell of a bull market over the course of this year, which is not really in line with the current market sentiment. And that's why I think right now, like, it's the 19th of March as I record this, right now is a good time to be thinking about buying some Bitcoin and just sit on it, see what happens. I'll leave you with one final point. I prefer to keep my capital in a system in which it is ruled by rules and not by rulers. And that is a massive, massive change versus what the status quo traditional financial system actually represents. Okay, next, I won't mention his name. I did this on a previous solo episode because they haven't given me permission to do so. But I have a little dog, Lulu, who's a miniature cavoodle thing. And I make the same terrible joke all the time that she's our attack dog. You know, she's like 5 kilos, tiny little fluffy thing. And the dog groomer came over this morning. He's got his van and chucks her in the van and gives her a groom. And at the very end, he's taking payment and just chatting a little bit. And I always try to do this as a Bitcoin advocate, is talk to people about it. And as I'm making payment, he's using Square on his phone to take dollars and chatting about how easy that now is because it's on the iPhone, not just on the little FPOS unit they used to have. And I say, oh, by the way, I'm a Bitcoin advocate. And if you're ever interested, I would very happily pay you in Bitcoin. And he's like, I'm a bit of a technophobe. I can't remember if that was the exact phrase he used, but like, I'm a late adopter. And then he made an interesting comment. It's like, my brother, I think it was, is over in the States and is banging on about the AI stock he's invested into and is essentially retired, and it just grinds my gears. I'm like, oh, well, you know, if you're ever interested about learning about Bitcoin, it's a whole different system. It's changed my life, you know, radically for the better. I have a podcast, the Jake Woodhouse podcast. Just, you know, maybe you've got spare 20 minutes, check it out. And I kind of got the impression that, like, I doubt he's ever going to look. Later, I get a text message. And it's like, Jake, I was podcasting with work today and I started listening. Thank you for welcoming me into your world. Isn't that cool? I hadn't really thought about it like that. It's like, okay, so we have this physical life where we're meeting people around us, we're getting goods and services for whatever we might need. And then we have this digital world where we're able to communicate in a way that's just never been possible before. Here I am recording on my own, a laptop microphone. I can post it online and it just can sit there for as long as is necessary, like as long as I choose for it to be there at a very, very low cost. Now, putting aside the discussion on like you are the product and social media platforms, and like when I post on YouTube, it's a low cost because I don't have to pay them a subscription fee, but they do all the data hosting, and then therefore they can dictate what gets said on their platform. And this idea of freedom of speech is not freedom of reach. And I can get into a whole spiel about why I think Noster is so exciting. But putting that aside, what I really want to look at is this idea of organic viral adoption from a bottom-up perspective. And that's what Bitcoin is, right? It is a totally grassroots movement. It really hits home when you think about the fact that there's no CEO, right? Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever he, she, they were, not from a, you know, pronoun-y perspective, but like we don't know. We can make our guesses, but we don't know. They gave this thing to the world in arguably one of the most selfless acts humanity's ever seen. And I would point you toward Eric Kaysen's writing and Crypto Sovereignty, the book he wrote. Eric's a great guy. I was lucky to meet him in person. And he just really hammers home how incredible this thing actually is for humanity. And it's people talking to each other. I benefited from it. I'm now telling people about it. Now, I think my big Bitcoin advocacy has altered over time, whereas like when you first get the bug, you're like, oh, this is the coolest thing ever. I can't not talk about it all day long. And I'm going to tweet 500 days times a day and, you know, tell every single person near me and try and turn all of my close family into like Bitcoin maximalists and all the rest of it. And what I've learned is that like it's that kind of age-old saying of like when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. And basically, most people, more often than not, just not interested. And that's okay. But you forcing something upon them is just not going to work. Like that whole idea again of like you can lead a horse to water, but you can't force it to drink. Until someone has an acute problem that they need to solve, and that problem can be solved by Bitcoin, then it's just not quite right. And so when you see viral adoption, like what, you know, arguably today will prove to be, like, for example, I also pay my boxing coach in Bitcoin. Didn't really know much about it. I'm like, would you like to be paid in Bitcoin? Help set up a self-custody wallet. Suddenly he's got a seed phrase sitting somewhere, and every week he's getting Bitcoin payments, starting to use it, receive, send, store. Whoa, hang on. I didn't have to give an ID to set this thing up. I didn't have to put an email address in. I tend to recommend a Moon wallet, which has worked very well for me, just for kind of, you know, smaller transactions and payments using the Bitcoin network itself, or Lightning. And it's just so easy for someone to set up. I mean, literally App Store, bang, download. Okay, address, poof, you've got Bitcoin in there. And like literally this guy, my PT, I do it with too. He's like, oh, what? Just literally immediate? Like, yeah. And so sometimes it's really fun to just put it out there like I did today. Say like, if you're interested, check it out. And I did not expect that text message. How freaking cool is that? Like, okay. And so welcome. And let's, you know, maybe you'll listen to this right now. The thing is that basically I feel strongly that people who associate themselves with being like Bitcoiners, who I've met a lot of people that think like this now. And I've interviewed, you know, over 100 now, at least, including my last podcast. They think differently. Their lives are better. And they now happily teach other people about that. That is probably the best example of a truly free market, organic, viral process. And it's why I think Bitcoin often gets related to religion. Like, how did the word of Christ like filter across the world, or any other of the major religions? It was through word of mouth. And okay, yes, over time, what grew up were these centralized entities where, you know, you had the Catholic Church and the Pope and all this kind of stuff, which is probably not what the grassroots guys were vouching for. And it got co-opted and it got corrupted. And that's human nature, wanting to get something for nothing. And I think we have to be very, 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 very careful that that doesn't happen with Bitcoin. To wind the clock back a few years, there's an excellent book called The Block Size Wars, where there was a big argument going on in the world of Bitcoin in 2016, 2017 about the block size. And the reason there was an argument about that was because the Bitcoin blockchain has a small block size in order for it to be usable for small-scale node runners. So people like myself can sit at home, plug their node into the internet, set it up, and it starts to calculate in a decentralized consensus all of the Bitcoin transactions that are actually happening, like a kind of guard keeper or an accountant, like I mentioned earlier, talking about the FASB stuff. And the thing that's so crazy about that is like the network itself, the small, the pleb, like for want of another word, like the small Bitcoin holder, the node runner, voted no in an emphatic fashion to bigger blocks. And the reason that that was so important is because they wanted to keep the block size small so that the node system could be super decentralized. It's very easy to run a node. Now, great highlights of what this could have been is if you look at Ethereum, how difficult it is to do Ethereum mining. And basically, most of Ethereum mining is done using large providers like Amazon Web Services because people can't do it on their own. And basically, it's not decentralized. And now that they've moved it to proof of stake as well, just really hammers that home. It's like large Ethereum holders control the system. They can change the rules. It's just like the fiat system. So when they say it's decentralized, when they say that, you know, this is the future of future global computer, like it's not the future of decentralized money. That's what it's not. And that's what Bitcoin is. And that's what I'm excited about. So I just ignore Ethereum, Solana, all these other blockchains that are now eating Ethereum's lunch. They're different, right? They're highly speculative software projects that may or may not create real world value in the future. I don't know. Can you speculate on their tokens? Absolutely. Do people get wrecked? Absolutely. Can some people navigate the difference between the price of Bitcoin and the price of an altcoin to capture more Bitcoin? Yes. And there are people out there that do that. And I suggest you go, you know, research their content and maybe if that's something that you like, go and learn about it. But what Bitcoin represents is it's an insanely viral and grassroots process. And I love that. And this text message I received today is precisely the kind of thing that I love to get back. Because, cool, maybe I've just helped slightly change that person's life. And the fact that they were disgruntled about a family member who's speculating on AI equities and is now supposedly retired, that is hyper fiat in terms of a gain. So, okay, if you can ride that NVIDIA stock forever, great. But what if NVIDIA doesn't work forever? What if they change the accounting rules and it means that the price to earnings ratios differ? And what if it now crashes to the downside? What if the cost of debt suddenly goes up and they're actually far more leveraged than they were supposed to be? It's a company. It has people in it. It's producing a product. It has a supply chain. Things can go wrong. I personally believe that an equity is much riskier than buying a piece of the Bitcoin network. And that's what a lot of people haven't realized. But the point of the viral side of this is that people are building their lives on top of Bitcoin. And Bitcoiners represent the social layer of Bitcoin. And this is where, shout out to the Wizard of Oz, who helped set up the Bitcoin Bush Bash here in Australia. Got to get you on the podcast as soon as I can, if I'm honest. Really just talk so well about this. It's like the people that have figured this thing out, the people that make decisions to make Bitcoin a big part of their lives, the benefits that they get are like all too obvious to see, right? People's lives are improving when they do this. And slowly but surely, they're telling other people. And that's why I get such confidence in Bitcoin long term. It's like, okay, I sit in self-custody. If you see NVIDIA drop by 30%, well, hang on a second. Maybe they can't meet their debt obligations of that quarter because the interest rate's gone up and now they haven't got the equity value to leverage against. And oh shit, it's just fallen another 20%. Well, that's an equity, right? That thing could go bankrupt. Whereas Bitcoin, it's a neutral monetary network with participants that are buying and selling every day for payments. Some, though, are holding long, long term as a store of value. When that price drops 30% or even 50%, if you see Bitcoin as a valuable long-term store of value, well, then the price just got 50% cheaper. You're going to buy. And so I see this like the foundations upon which Bitcoin is built are stronger than any other asset I've ever seen. I think that's probably a good way of putting it. So final thing I want to talk through is something I've been working on with Jason Parks. Shout out to Jason. And I haven't finished, but it's still... it's really cool to think about, which is it's basically decision making. And I've talked about this recently, actually, but I'll just use it as an example. I'm trying to figure out where I want to live with my family, and I have to obviously house them in the short term. So that really requires renting a property. But maybe I'd like to buy a house. But actually, if I buy a house, I buy someone else's problems. So maybe I want to build a house, but that's obviously a much more long-term project. You definitely don't want to do it in a place that you don't want to be in 5 years' time. And so there's a number of balls in the air. But what Jason will tell you is it all comes back to self-image. And it's like, okay, what is the picture of my life that I'm working towards? Who is Jake of the future? And, you know, some of the things I want to be doing in my life, like podcasting is one. Well, here I am doing it. Another is investing. Well, I'm also doing that specifically as a Bitcoin holder at the moment, but I will also do more venture capital stuff. I really love the idea of early stage innovation, entrepreneurship, people with big ideas. How do you get capital to the right people at the right time? And who are the people to back? Like, that is a fascinating question. Do I think that innovation and like good equity returns in illiquid, high-risk, early-stage investing are gone because of Bitcoin? No, absolutely not. People still need to build stuff, and there's a place for it. But then it's like, okay, maybe I've got more musical instincts or more artistic instincts. Like, how do I actually bring those to the table? Obviously, I'm a father. I want to spend as much time with my kids before they hit the age of 12 as I possibly can. After that, I'm pretty confident they're not going to care so much. I saw a stat yesterday that shows that 75% of the time you spend with your children is before they're 12. I mean, one of my daughters is going to be 5 this year. Like, you're basically halfway there. And so you've got all these things in your life that you want. I want to travel, like go to certain countries, see certain things. I want to be in a loving relationship with my wife. I want to improve as a person. I want to have certain relationships. And so all of these things that you want, they need to be part of your vision. They need to be part of your self-image, as Jason describes it. And what we're trying to work on is like, well, what's the 10-year vision? And what do I want to be doing 10 years from now? What do I want to have achieved 10 years from now? And in some ways, it's like a hyper-intuitive flow process where it's like you sit down, you might have done a workout, you might have done a meditation, whatever, and you go, okay, what is Jake Woodhouse going to be doing in 2035? What do I want? And before you know it, just stuff just starts coming out, right? And then it's a case of them refining that. Like, for example, like one thing I really love to do is to be able to speak a second language. And I studied French and Spanish as I was a teenager, but never really followed through. And my French is perhaps a little bit better, but it's still not ideal. And what I'm thinking is like, okay, well, when you start going through the list of like all the things that you want to do, it's like, is that actually something you want to do? And you kind of double down and you write why. And really what I want there is like, when I'm in France, I want to be able to speak French, but I'm not in France. And so do I actually want that like right now? And I guess what I'm learning is we are learning machines. We are problem solving machines. And so what we can do is go, okay, I'm actually going to put that on the back burner, not necessarily part of the vision for 10 years, but as and when the time arises that I actually want that skill, then I'll fix that at that time. And so you end up with actually much more like a set of ethics. And it's like, and that's the cool bit. It's like, this is the type of character I want to be every day, you know, 10 years from now. This is what I will be. And so once you figure out that vision, then you're like, okay, now I can start to think through my self-image. Like, what is it that I actually do? And what I'm learning is that until you're able to actually like specifically think through what that day would look like, what that life would look like, you're actually incapable of creating it. And so if you think it's impossible to do two things at once, random example, be a house music DJ and also be a venture capital investor. If you can't imagine doing those two things at the same time, then you'll never do it. And so one has to be very, very precise and clear about what it is you're going to go and achieve over that time. And so then you can point your attention at it. And what happens is you end up with a set of ethics, as I mentioned. And when it comes to decision making, you can come back to that. So like, do I want to rent? Do I want to buy? Do I want to build? I'm still figuring this out, don't get me wrong. But it's like, well, what does that decision look like against your pre-existing set of ethics? Is that something that fits into that, yes or no? And you basically end up with this decision making machine that makes it really easy to be like, that's a load of waste of time, waste of time, waste of time, waste of time. And in particular, where this is cool for me is previous podcasting that I've done and other entrepreneurial exploits, I have had opportunities come to me where other people like what they see, and they want it as part of their vision on whatever they're building. And I previously saw that as me manifesting opportunities. And I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. I was thinking about something just like this. This is a sign. I'm in. How do I sign up? But now I'm getting more sophisticated at this process, thanks to Jason. It's actually like, well, hang on. That opportunity has got nothing to do with my self-image. So it's a no, straight away. And I think that's where I've made a lot of mistakes in the past, frankly. It's like, actually, that's other people wanting a piece of you. So like, you can own a piece of the Bitcoin network, great. But like, can you own a piece of someone else? Well, you can try, come in as my business partner or come in as my employee. And it's then up to you, be like, well, hang on, what do I want? And what am I working towards? And does that fit into that process? And so in some ways, it's like an extreme filter on the energy around us that's constantly trying to take our attention in different places. And so we can come back, and then it's that absolute truth that like, our attention is our scarcest resource, and you have to point it where you want to go. A final example of that is I found myself in a situation with the rental property that I'm in, which is, sadly, it's full of mold. And I believe this is just due to the process of when it was built. It was a super wet period of time. Even though it's a fairly new built house, there's mold in the walls. We had a whole load of tests done, got proof that that was the case. And we haven't been able to find an alternative opportunity to go and live in. And so we've actually suffered from mold exposure as a family. Now, one big lesson there is you can't live in a Bitcoin. You need to have a better base. Like Jake, you need to have a better base of like, fuck you. And shout out to Ben Gunn for that kind of insight. It's like you're living somewhere that's actually not a healthy home. And it's dampening you down. It's lowering your frequency. But am I going to go and have a fight with the landlord who's already someone I know that's hyper-stressed, not interested in helping, doesn't want to spend any money? Am I going to go and take them to court for supplying an unhealthy home and get dragged into like whatever that means, like low layer anger, frustration, poor frequency? Or is it a case of, well, actually, is taking people to court for problems that they've created for me part of my vision? Or is it more a case of like, actually, no, I just need to focus down on what I'm trying to create? And so again, it's like, it's not just opportunities that come in, it's situations you find yourself in. You're like, well, that's just not worth my attention. It's literally not worth it. And so I guess it comes back to how you value your time. And it's a work in progress for me, but I hope thinking this kind of stuff through is helpful. And I encourage you to reach out to Jason and get some mentoring from him if that's something you're interested in. And just generally, like, whenever I've chosen to invest in myself, the ROI has always been higher than I expected. And this is one of those classic examples. That's enough for me today. Awesome solo rip. Great to get some of that stuff on my chest. If you're still listening, you're an absolute legend for getting to the end of 40 minutes or so of me ranting and raving away. So thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.